Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is the show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution, but all too often, we don't think enough about them. Our goal is to break up complicated topics into small enough bits that we can integrate some aspect into our lifestyle. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered at the in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit the site, you can ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. We encourage and welcome your questions. Today's show is titled Loneliness. At one time or another, everyone has felt lonely. It's a common human emotion, but taken to the extreme, it can force us into a lifestyle trap that's very difficult to get out of. Love is the desire for unity, and loneliness is the opposite of love. Although the spiritual realm is the ultimate feeling of love, the earth plane can be the ultimate feeling of loneliness. Like all of our emotions, learning to understand loneliness is the first step in overcoming it. Today's guest is Dr. David Nerung, author of Leaving Loneliness, a Workbook. Dr. Nerung is a clinical psychologist and Buddhist working in Santa Monica, California. He did his undergraduate studies at Kent State, where he graduated magna cum laude, and he also received a PhD in clinical psychology from Kent State. Dr. David Nerung. Welcome to the show, David. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show to discuss what I think is a really important topic for, you know, really our whole nation.
You know, I think so, too. You know, we live in a world of 7 billion people, and we live in a country, many of us anyway, United States, which is pushing 400 million. Yet a huge number of people say they're lonely. And do you see loneliness as a growing problem in the United States?
Well, there's a mixed picture there. You know, with so much social media available, there are a lot of opportunities for people to have some level of connection with a lot of other people. But the research on the topic shows that it doesn't really help our loneliness unless we turn those online connections into face-to-face contact. And what I really believe is diminishing is the ability to listen skillfully to each other, because we just don't have as much time as we used to. And so loneliness, I think, is on the rise because we are having difficulty really hearing each other, and we're also not sharing our experiences as deeply with others, again, out of that sense of being rushed.
You know, it's to me, of course, I'm an old fogey compared to this, the social media and such. But to me, I don't know how you can really communicate with people when you're doing it over a device. It seems like communication is really eyeball to eyeball most of the time. Not always, but most of the time. Do you find that to be the case?
I think that for people to really have the kind of connection where they feel understood and that they're sharing themselves and that they are hearing what you know somebody else is really sharing about themselves, eyeball to eyeball is a whole lot better. And I think social media is useful for loneliness only if it leads to people getting to that face-to-face contact. That's when it can help. But in the end, we need that kind of gut-level connection with each other to feel close. And that can really only, we can only share that level of emotion and experience when we're together.
A lot of it are visual signs, too. You know, and you don't get a lot of those over the over the technology, even if you got a video connection with people.
No, and yeah, that's, I think, why we wind up with so many missed connections where people are firing off angry missives over email or social media to each other that they would never do if they were face-to-face, because there's just not the body language to support having that conversation over, you know, electronically.
Yeah. Do you think this is a hidden problem? Do you think people, you know, there's certain problems that people just don't like to own up to? Is loneliness one of them?
Oh, yes. I think there's still huge stigma around loneliness. It was one of the reasons for writing the book, because it's such a common problem. And people don't talk about this one. People feel a lot of shame when they admit that they're lonely. And, you know, there was a fairly recent study showing that about 35% of people in the States would be classified as lonely. And a quarter of people in a very large scale interview didn't even feel they had anyone they could turn to in a time of either big distress or big joy. And so that's a lot of people. But
that's a huge number. You know, you multiply that by 350 or 400 million people in this country, and you've got a staggering number of people that feel that way. In your book, you say that a lot of adult loneliness is caused in childhood. What are some of the circumstances in childhood that cause adult loneliness?
Well, that is, you know, the book really focuses on attachment theory. And so that's where I'm coming from when I talk about early relationship experiences and how they form us. So if we come to see the world, the social world, as unavailable or, you know, dismissive or denigrating of us, or even just downright dangerous, then we tend to project that image of others onto our social world, and we treat others as if they're exactly the same of everyone we knew earlier on. So, you know, of course, experiences like just outright physical or sexual abuse or, you know, emotional neglect will lead people to look at their social world with a little less optimism and to regard people as either unsupportive or dangerous. And that really affects their, you know, what psychology refers to as their attachment style. So that's where I focus the book, is around their around attachment styles and how to improve them.
Right. The, you know, you're a Buddhist, and as such, do you believe that any of this, anybody's loneliness is a result of karma, old karma from previous lives that they need to work on?
Ah, good question. This is the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm not in a psychology room. As a Buddhist, yes, I do. I believe that we all have our things that we need to work out in this lifetime, and that within the human experience, a lot of that being our relationships, and that, yeah, some of our struggles come from older times, and we can work them out here and now, and learn what we need to learn. And so definitely that's part of my personal belief about how we become lonely and what we, you know, that it's something we need to resolve in this life.
Yeah. Attachment theory. I read your book. I enjoyed the book. And indeed, it's about attachment theory. Why don't you tell the listeners what is attachment theory? Explain it to us a little bit.
Okay. And that, you know, that's a great question. Thank you. Because it's why I wrote the book. I wanted to bring something that psychologists are very familiar with and break it down so that it makes sense to everybody who's interested. So attachment theory is something that helps us understand how we relate to other people and whether we have trust in others and ourselves to have safe, secure connections with others. And attachment theory is really rooted in a very primal sort of system that we need to be near each other to be safe. We are not very strong animals. We don't have claws, we don't even have fangs, anything like that, so that we tend to cluster together for safety, so that if we're apart from the herd, we ought to feel some pain as a signal to drive us back together. And when we are what's called securely attached, we look at others as competent to help us emotionally. We see ourselves as strong and able to help them. And we assume good intent in others until proven differently. And, you know, on the other side, there are several ways of being insecurely attached, which cause a lot of relationship problems. And one of them is attachment avoidance, where we just don't seem to know how to get close to people, how to share ourselves, and how to get at their own inner thoughts, emotions, and experiences. So we just don't get close. And the other really common kind of attachment insecurity, preoccupied attachment, is where we're so focused on what is the status of our relationships. Do others really care about us? Do they care about us as much as we care about them? Have we made a mistake that's going to cost us dearly in that relationship? Are our relationships okay? And so we can kind of cling to others and imagine that there's somebody they're not who will meet our needs, and get terribly disappointed when they are turn out to be who they actually are, and then the relationship tends to explode. So that's attachment theory in a nutshell. It basically says, do I believe that I'm lovable fundamentally, and do I believe that others are able and willing to care about me, or am I unsure about those things?
So you broke it up in the book as secure, as you just said. There's three styles you broke up. The other one was avoidance, which you explained, and then anxiety. So those are the three different styles. And the one good one is secure, and that's what we want to get ourselves into that relationship, or have a mindset that allows us to get into that. And the other two are things that we need to look at, the avoidance and the anxiety, and maybe see what some of the issues are that are causing us to feel that way.
That's right. We need to, if we're struggling, and really, you know, what the power of attachment theory is that if we're repeating the same problem relationships over and over again, we find we never seem to find a way to get close, or we seem to have relationships that form quickly and then explode and disappear, that those are not mystical anymore, that there is a way to think about them and get to work. And a lot of that work is considering what is it that happened in my past relationships, especially early on. Not always. Sometimes there's a trauma in later years, but what is it that happened earlier on that I'm carrying into today? And how am I making the past alive in the present in a way that's hurting my ability to connect with other people? And once people start to think about that it's not, you know, our past isn't just our past, it lives on, but all of our past isn't relevant, only specific things that may have led us to look at our social world as unsafe.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about some of the obstacles that keep us from having a secure attachment to people. What are some of the key things that people should think about in their life?
Okay. Well, you know, one thing is definitely, again, going back to any childhood trauma, but it might not be that dramatic. It might just be that people didn't really understand us very well when we were young, didn't seem to understand our thoughts and feelings, and maybe didn't have time to listen to us closely. Maybe a parent was working very, very hard just to help the family survive. But that for some reason there was difficulty as a child expressing their thoughts and feelings and having somebody just receive it without a ton of advice, without a lot of problem solving or false reassurance or, you know, those sorts of things to cut off the kid's emotional experience, but they really got to tell somebody. And if they didn't have that experience, they'll know that they're going to have some trouble with one key part of attachment, and that is our ability to handle a large amount of intense emotion. Every close relationship requires us to be able to handle a lot of intense emotion. Anyone who's been a member of a couple knows that being a member of a couple brings up a lot of stuff. And there can be long periods where it's really smooth, but there's going to be some conflict and just, if nothing else, a difference. And those differences and conflicts, if we are not ready to handle all the emotion that comes with it, we can take that emotion too seriously. So one thing that people can work on is just saying to themselves, this might hurt a little. You know, if I want to get close to somebody, this might cause me a little bit of emotional distress, whereas I was hoping that this relationship would just bring me, you know, peace and understanding and happiness. It's also going to bring some discomforts, and to just kind of acknowledge and accept that. So emotional, you know, the ability to regulate our emotions and to tolerate a large amount of discomfort, that really helps us become secure if we're not already. And another is just looking at the quality of our listening. Listening to ourselves, including anything that we might be ashamed of in ourselves, emotions we wish we did not have. And doing the same for others. Can we really listen to people? When do we cut off? When do we get defensive? When do we stop listening? And noticing that, because the more we can hear people, the longer we can stay. And the longer we can stay engaged, the closer that relationship's going to become.
Yeah, I like that. That's a good point. You know, one of the things that you said is that we're afraid, or we can be afraid of what we can do, not can't do, but can do. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a more subtle point. I encounter that a lot working as a therapist too. You know, we can scare ourselves feeling responsible that if we do something big in our life or with others in our life, that we're ever more expected to do it. And that can put some pressure on us. And it also, sometimes it just feels more comfortable to stay small, just not to look around too much and to focus on very specific tasks and very specific things that we've done over and over again and feel comfortable with. But security is a lot about being able to lift our heads up a little and look around the world and see who's there and what's there, and to be okay with not knowing everything about what's going on there. And when we can do that, we can start taking on bigger projects, more meaningful, larger things that we want to do, because we can handle the ambiguity of not having done it already and not being certain of what we can do or can't do, of just testing our limits a little bit. And because, you know, one big part of becoming secure is knowing that it's okay if we fail, that we have a theory of failure, that it's all right. It's not, we won't whip ourselves mercilessly. We won't be, you know, angry at ourselves forever if we make mistakes. And that gives us freedom, if we love ourselves like that, that gives us freedom to look around and try new things and to expand, because we're not in danger of losing our own affection for ourselves.
You know, that's really interesting. You see it at work, or I saw it in my working days. For certain people, very capable people, just didn't want to move to the next level or take on any more responsibility. They were really good at what they did. They said, "Hey, that's what I want to do." But I never really thought about it as how it affected, you know, personal relationships and loneliness and such like that. It's an interesting point that you bring up.
Yeah, and I think that willingness to take on and try new things and allow ourselves to fail, it also relates to meeting new people, you know? I mean, so what if we're in some gathering and we talk to somebody and they're not interested, or they don't like us, or they judge us, or something like that. I mean, that's what most people are afraid of, that they'll be judged poorly or just rejected. And if we don't throw ourselves in the trash can about that, and if we tell ourselves it's okay, we don't always have to succeed, sometimes we learn, then it does. It allows us to try out things we wouldn't try otherwise, and to expand our view of the world and open up.
Yeah. Gratitude is another thing that I you brought up in the book that I didn't understand. How does gratitude play into loneliness?
And by the way, a plug for your show. I listened to your episode on gratitude. I thought it was really a really enjoyable show. It was well done.
Thank you.
But from my take, gratitude, it's just we all know when something doesn't go our way and we want to scream about it inside or outside. And that's fine. I think it's artificial to pretend we feel good when we don't. So when I talk about gratitude, what I'm not talking about first, I'm not talking about forcing some false, Pollyanna, basically revisiting the scenario in a way that's not accurate to us. We have to be genuine. But what we can do is genuinely ask ourselves, okay, maybe I'm not happy about this or that, but we can ask ourselves, what is, you know, some of the inherent good in the situation? So, you know, you brought up work. Say someone doesn't get a promotion that they want. That's going to hurt. And I think that they shouldn't dismiss that. If they brush over that too quick, that's false. They're not listening to their true emotions about the scenario. But after they've heard themselves out and they've complained a little, so to speak, which is a good thing, they can move on to, well, you know, what does this teach me about what I need to learn? It might be skills, it might be political savvy, it might be many different things. But they can kind of move on to, okay, you know, what am I going to get from this? And how am I going to grow from this? Because any experience is a possibility, allows the possibility for growth. And if we take that approach, then we can acknowledge our pain, but we can also, you know, we can also see some room for development in anything that happens.
Okay. Yeah, that's good. All right. Well, how would we address some of the avoidance and anxiety issues? How do we go about, you know, we have them, we're lonely. How do we address them? What do we do? What are some of the things we could do?
Okay. Well, you know, there's this researcher, John Cacioppo. He's a professor at the University of Chicago, and he talks about he doesn't put it this way, but the way I see it, it's probably one way in practical terms that attachment shows up in our life. And what he says, actually I'm going to quote him, the person who starts out with the painful, even frightening sensation of being alone may begin to see dangers everywhere on the social landscape. Filtered through the lens of lonely social cognition, other people may appear more critical, competitive, denigrating, or otherwise unwelcoming. And so when we don't feel so sure that we're lovable and that others are safe and competent to respond to us, we start to see them in ways that are not quite accurate. We start to see the social world as more dangerous, more competitive, and more critical. So one of the things that people can do is set to work on changing those, you know, looking at themselves. What views do I have of my social world that are discouraging and that make me not want to try? What do I think about others or myself that is taking me out of the game? And
that requires a lot of self-honesty, doesn't it? I mean, you got to, you know, to get to the root of it, you're probably running into some things that maybe you didn't want to own up to yourself.
Very much. And, you know, that kind of goes back to that tolerance for uncomfortable feeling. If people have been lonely a long time and they want to get out of it, they can't stay in their comfort zone, because the comfort zone is stay detached. And that's not going to do it. So, you know, looking at ourselves is uncomfortable sometimes. We see things we don't want to see about ourselves, things we wish were not true, that we wish it was just all the outside world, but it's not. It's how we relate to it. But that doesn't make the other extreme true, that we're some huge problem, we're some defective whatever, you know. That's the other place people go. If they're not defective, then I must be. And having things to work on is very different than I have some primal, you know, fundamental inadequacy, incorrectness, and if you know, so I don't want anybody to see me. No, we can't go there either. We have to correct that. Just because we have something to work on, so you know, we have to get to work. But
everybody has something to work on. I think that's what a lot of people don't recognize. There is nobody that's here. That's why we're here, because we have something to work on. But sometimes that gets lost in the you know, in the self-analysis that, hey, wait a minute, I'm no worse than anybody else. I just have this problem, that's all.
Yeah, I agree completely. From that spiritual perspective, that's why we're here. That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to figure out what's blocking us from expanding and to address it and kind of muster up the courage and, you know, allow ourselves not to already be there so that we can move.
Yeah, exactly. And another one of the things you mentioned is you have to ask yourself, is my guard up? You know, I kind of like that, because I think we have a tendency to have our guard up when we don't know we have our guard up. But all of a sudden it comes out real easy because somebody says something, and all of a sudden, and it's often a misunderstood or innocent comment, and all of a sudden we're all over them, and it's because we have our guard up.
Yeah, maybe we don't want them to see something in us that we really don't like, and they see it. And yeah, our guard, I think, is, you know, sometimes our guard serves a purpose. If we sense that they are aggressive towards us, great, but that's not a problem. But what is what you're talking about. We often prop it up just because they see us. And that, you know, that comes with the fundamental assumption again that if we have a flaw, it's not okay. And therefore, if, you know, being seen having a flaw is even worse, you know, that's really intolerable. No, don't, it's bad enough that I have it. Don't look, please.
Don't. Yeah, right. Don't find it.
Don't find it. At least pretend it doesn't exist. Help me out here. And maybe the help is sometimes to notice it so that we can see how we're very unaccepting of our flaws, and we have a huge reaction to its existence.
You know, the other thing that people maybe don't recognize that you pointed out in the book is ask yourself, do I neglect emotional needs? And I guess that's your own emotional needs, and as well as others. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, when I think of, for example, when I work with families, parents and kids, it's going to be hard for the parent to attend to the kid's needs until they work on noticing their own first. And I think that's true of all of us in all our relationships. It's just very stark in those situations. We, you know, if we've gotten by, if we've coped by tuning out from our emotions, and we've, you know, we've devalued them to the point that we don't even notice them anymore, then we're going to get overwhelmed when we see emotional needs in others. We won't be able to listen, and we'll jump in with too quick solutions and false reassurance and all sorts of things just out of, uh-oh, I'm getting overwhelmed. I'll give you an example. There was a study that comes to mind, and people were put under some stress. And the ones with attachment avoidance, which are the kind of group that have really tuned out from their emotions, they showed the same physiological signs of stress as anybody else. And in this study, it was like, it was sweat, okay, galvanic skin response. And they showed that, but they were the ones where their self-report of how stressed they were had very little to do with what their bodies were showing. Everybody else, if they said they were stressed, yeah, they're sweating more. Or if they say they're not, they're sweating less. For those who were, you know, distant from their emotions, that correspondence between what they said about their stress and what their body knew, the correspondence wasn't there. So then how can they take care of themselves until they know what their emotions are? So the first step is just, we have to notice again, and that's sort of where mindfulness comes in, and, you know, walking down the street and just asking oneself, like, what do I notice sensorily even? What do I smell? What do I hear? What do I taste? What do my feet feel like on the ground? Reconnecting with our sensation. And that can help steer us back towards getting back in contact with our emotion. Once we know our emotion, we have an easy time providing for ourselves, oftentimes. But until we know what we feel and why, what triggered it, it's hard to do anything about it. And then we wouldn't be so good at helping out others.
Yeah, good point. Well, you know, we've talked a lot about the, you know, the obstacles and the problems that, you know, that we may have. What are some of the things that we can do to create and cultivate a secure attachment? What are some of the positive steps that we can take?
Okay. Well, what I'll do is run through a couple of steps then in leaving loneliness that I, you know, am suggesting people take. The first step is really to review the past relationships, and where they feel that the injury to their trust occurred, or the injury to feel understood or lovable, those sorts of injuries to their, you know, their connection with the interpersonal world. How did those injuries occur? And balancing it out with the good things, who was there for them, who was caring. But to kind of, and at the beginning of the workbook, I have people kind of write down a few pages about the relationship history that they've had so far, and what happens within their relationships when they feel unsafe or distressed. Who do they turn to, and what happened when they turn to them? Moving beyond that, looking at the second step would be, how do those old wounds play out at present? What did they take from those experiences and sort of project onto the social world now? Do they still see others as unsafe in some particular way, or see their own opinions as invalid or themselves as unlovable? So just to know that gives people a lot of power to see how the past impacts them at present, because it gives them some power to change it in the moment when they see themselves acting the same way as they would have before. It made sense before. It doesn't make sense now to be the same way. And then they can resolve that the job in relationships is not necessarily to feel comfortable. The hard part of forming close relationships that are consistent is tolerating the emotional, you know, waxing and waning, the complexity of stormy emotions they may feel, especially early on, and to make their peace with that. That it's not just getting closer to feel good, it's getting closer, yes, to feel good, but also it comes with that need to tolerate a wide range of emotions and to start to get comfortable with that idea. Third, they can come at and directly challenge some of those beliefs about the social world, that social cognition that others are dangerous or highly competitive, or, you know, that there's no altruism, you know, whatever unhelpful beliefs they have about the social world, they can identify them and start to, you know, basically counter them and get some counterexamples. And finally, and this is really the thing that destroys attachment insecurity and moves people towards security, the bottom line is all those other things are preparation for the big game, where when we are really joyful or really upset, we're having a real strong emotion, that we bare our neck to somebody who we trust to do that with, and we've built a foundation with, that we do it. We take that risk, we bare our neck, and we get that good response, hopefully, and repeat that again and again, rinse and repeat, until we sort of feel it in our gut that other people are reliable, we're worthy of care, we're competent to seek it out, other people are competent to give it. And that's how we start to develop a sense of give and take, that we can get help, we can offer it, and that there's a reciprocity, that we can be successfully interdependent.
And so that we need to take the risk.
We need to take the risk, and that helps us open our heart in the end.
Okay. You know, you talked a lot about, some about forgiving ourselves and forgiving others. I thought that was really good in the book, where I guess we have a tendency to judge. Mm-hmm. And we live in a society of judgment, don't we? I mean, you know, everything. You know, we're raised religion of judgment. You know, there's obviously our legal system that somebody judges us all over the place. So we judge too, and we judge ourselves and we judge others. Now you talk a little bit about how important, you know, forgiving ourselves and forgiving others are.
You know, especially if we've had disappointments that hurt us. We can tend to take failures very hard because they've done us some injury, whether because we've failed or others have failed us in some very big way. But as we grow and we develop more power, especially as adults, we can repair ourselves. It's, you know, we're able to come back from being injured. And so we don't have to take those experiences so, so hard. I think that forgiveness to me means, again, you know, like the concept of gratitude, it's not something that we're just should force our mind into. I must forgive, like a compulsive thing, and then I'm good, then I'm doing it right. first, if we acknowledge the injury that we have sustained and we think about how it affected us, how are we hurt? Then after we do that piece first, we can move on and we won't have so much resistance to forgiving. If we try and brush over the injury, we probably won't really forgive. But if we acknowledge the wound, but we appreciate the other person, how they came to do what they came to do, how they got in that position, what's their own history, how did they come to do that thing that they did, that helps us to put them in context. And then, yeah, ultimately forgiveness is our own freedom. It's really not just for them, it's really for us, so that we can feel no longer preoccupied. We're not devoting a thread of energy to that person and what happened anymore. But it's sort of like the outcome, I think, of a successful process. Forgiveness is the outcome of looking at what happened, how we felt about it, who the other person is, and how they came to do what they did. That done, it becomes easier for us to let it go, wish them well in our minds, and just move forward.
Yeah, take a broader view of the situations that we found ourselves in and we found them
in. Yes, rather than just that moment in time.
Exactly.
They got to be who they are, probably honestly. You know, they came to their behavior honestly, just as we do, and you know, we have that humility that we hurt people too. But if it was a really big hurt, we have to look at their history. How did they come to do that to us?
Right. How do we help others? How can individuals and societies reduce loneliness by reaching out to people? What's a good way to do that?
I feel refreshed just hearing that question. I think it's a great question. You know, there are two things I think we can do. From my point of view, again, I'll go back to one thing, listening closely. So if we're really busy, and many people are, while we're with somebody, we can try to be with them. It might not be for that long. We might only be near them for a minute or a few minutes, but while we're having an interaction, we can try and really bring our mind to that interaction and focus on them, because we're not good at divided attention. There is a lot of research to show even people who think they're great multitaskers are not. Their attention is fragmented when they're multitasking. Given that it's a reality that there's a lot of multitasking in the modern world, still, when someone is trying to tell us something that we can see is important to them, we can be with them and really try and just listen and hear their experience and not cut them off with that sort of false reassurance and you know, problem solving before it's time for that. So that's one thing. So that's, I think, the most important thing. We need to try and listen. The other thing we haven't gotten into yet, I haven't said, is how we deal with it when we encounter differences in others, different points of view.
Yep.
And you know, there's so much of that going on right now, you know, really, that's just intense bickering and violence beyond that. Well, we get really lonely when we have to fight for our opinions to exist. It becomes this existential battle, and it's two people behind bunkers firing at each other, trying to knock each other down. Either I'm going to convert you or I'm going to kill you. I'm not making light of that. Recently, that literally happened.
Literally happens almost every week, maybe every day.
Yeah, so we need, and this just comes from a coupling model by Bob and Rita Resnick. They're a couple of psychologists. And the idea is that if you have a different point of view than me, I can listen to you, you can listen to me, if we realize that the difference doesn't have to erase either of us, that that you will exist, I will exist, and your point of view doesn't invalidate or make my point of view or make it unworthy. And that freedom from having to survive, to have to prove why my opinion is so correct, it frees me to be able to listen to you, because I'm not worried about my own. My opinion probably won't change in our conversation. It might a little bit, but it doesn't have to. But if we hear each other's opinions, we soften towards each other, and we don't regard each other as the enemy anymore. It's just different. And
do you think when somebody goes, you know, be a terrorist, or, you know, somebody does something extreme, do you think that maybe is loneliness reaching a panic or phobia state?
Sometimes I think that it's cultivated as such by, you know, the leaders of those organizations. Here, you know, we are the heavens, there is the devil, and creating that split is saying, you know, if you band together with us, you have connection, you have righteousness as well, I suppose. That's how it's proposed, put out to them.
Like-mindedness,
and, you know, that you can't have the entire world. I think the leaders of those sorts of organizations put out there that you can't be one with the entire world. You have to be one with only those who see things exactly the way that you do. And that kind of anger and split, you know, good, bad, it generates loneliness by definition, because I only feel connected when I'm with this group, and otherwise, you know, I'm in territory with a different species. And so I think they exploit people to develop that sense of the social world, that the others are dangerous, and, you know, fear them, which is inherently a lonely point of view to hold.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've run out of time here, and we've really just touched the you know, a few of the highlights in your book, Leaving Loneliness, a workbook. I encourage people to get it. It's a way to help look at yourself, and I think it was very, very well done. How can people find you in the book and what you're doing?
Well, for the book, it's on Amazon, and again, it's called Leaving Loneliness. And to find me, my website is strongerrelationships.org, and so they can look me up that way. And definitely any questions that they might leave with you in the chat room, I'd love to address.
Okay, great. It's Dr. David Narang, and that's spelled N-A-R-A-N-G. So if you're looking him up, that's the spelling for it. David, hey, it's been great to have you on. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. I think it's a topic that needs more attention and more focus. We need to find our way to each other in this world.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows will be posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website. I'll publish those answers as well. Also, I cover all these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.